This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Brian Eno is well known in the worlds of rock and experimental music. He brought the conceptualism of the classical avant-garde into the world of rock. In 1971, he co-founded the British band Roxy Music with Brian Ferry. Eno played synthesizer and electronically manipulated the sounds of the other musicians in the group. Eno left Roxy Music, made albums on his own, and started his own label that recorded albums of atmospheric electronic music. He became an important figure in the new wave scene of the 70s, producing records by Talking Heads and Devo. Eno has also produced records by David Bowie, Robert Fripp, and U2. Now, for the first time in 13 years, he sings on a record of songs. The album Wrong Way Up is a collaboration with John Cale. Eno sings on this song, Lay My Love, which was co-written by Eno and Cale. Record is really a return to song for you. Mm-hmm. Why did you want to go back to songs?
The question I hate answering.
Because it's too hard or because you don't want to admit
it? No. I guess it's the main reason I didn't do a song record for so long, because they're always seen as so separate in everyone's mind that it's either songs or not songs. I suppose it's easier to tell you why I didn't do song records for a long time.
Okay.
And the main reason for that was because I was trying to make a kind of music that wasn't so personality-based and that wasn't really based on the idea of a musical performance, of a performance having happened somewhere, of which this was a record, you understand. I wanted to do something that was music as if it, or sound that had been recorded somehow without the intervention of human beings, in particular me. So I left the voice out of things for quite a long time. But I never stopped singing. I've always been a singer, I guess.
Now, you're still working on your ambient music also, right? Your electronic mm-hmm. music. Would you describe what the ambient music is?
It started out as really a response. I mean, like all my music starts, I guess, as me thinking, I wish some music like this existed. I imagine a kind of music that I would like to hear. It doesn't exist, so I start to make it. Or I hear something, on the other hand, and I think, God, if only they'd done it this way, it could have been so much better. So I sometimes start by remaking other things that I hear in what I consider to be an incomplete form. Well, the whole ambient thing really arose from watching the way that people were listening to music as opposed to the way that composers were making music. There seemed to me that there had developed a big lag in between those two operations. Composers were still making records as though people ran back home with the disc or the CD and sat down in front of their speakers with their attention riveted and listened to every detail and nuance of the recording. Well, of course, that used to happen, but and it still does. It's rather the classical music model of listening. But what more typically happened is that people would buy the record, take it home, put it on, get on the phone, do the washing up, vacuum clean, do all the sorts of things that one does. Write a letter, read a book, and have the music on at the same time. So I thought it was quite clear to me that people were using music much more as a form of landscape, really.
Mm-hmm.
They were creating an atmosphere for themselves by means of music. And I thought also that most music was not designed with that idea in mind, and in a certain sense it didn't work very well for that job. So I want to make a music that could allow you to do that, that could occupy different attention spaces in your life, so that you could stop and listen to it and give it that kind of old-fashioned attention, or you could just have it playing and get on with something else. It didn't demand particular levels of attention. It offered the option of lots of different ones.
You have a record that is still a work in progress now. You're still working on it, but we have a couple of tracks from this forthcoming album. And I want to play something that you've called Ripples in Time. Would you put this in the category of the ambient music?
Yes, I would. That piece isn't quite finished yet, but I'm hoping, in fact, I'm trying, I haven't succeeded yet, to add a 16-piece string orchestra to this piece. And we've done a little work on that, but it hasn't quite worked out yet. So this could become rather a different piece from what it sounds like at the moment. But it certainly fits in that same category, I think. Ambient also is rather a good alibi for slipping what can be quite abstract pieces of music to people in a way that doesn't intimidate them. You know, if you say, hey, you know, this is nothing in particular, just you can treat it as background music if you like, it gives you a certain freedom to operate outside of any of the known sets of expectations about what music should be. So I'm kind of interested in using that category as a way of generating a kind of post-classical contemporary music, and I hope that pieces like this will be the beginning of that.
Well, let's listen to Ripples in Time, and this is A Work in Progress by Brian Eno. Composer, musician, producer, and synthesizer player Brian Eno is my guest. Now, you came to music from art school when you were still a student. You were in art school. You didn't play an instrument. You didn't read music, but you had a synthesizer, which of course is an instrument, and you were using a tape recorder, I think, in very musical ways, manipulating it. How has that continued to shape your sense of who you are as a musician? Do you still think of yourself as a non-musician, even though you've been playing music for so many years?
I do, I suppose, yes. I think that, the tape recorder was certainly the most important thing for me, because the tape recorder, as far as I was concerned, turned music into a plastic art. It meant that it was possible to do all sorts of operations to sound that didn't actually require traditional musical talents. So I started out working in music with quite a different idea about what music could be, and that idea hasn't really changed. It's just been enlarged, but at the basis I still have this feeling that music is now a new art since the tape recorder.
Well, it's interesting to me that you have this, well, you know, pretty avant-garde sense of what music is or can be. And you've chosen to take that concept to pop music as opposed to, say, the classical avant-garde. And I think a lot of your ideas initially would have been much more at home in the classical avant-garde, because there were other composers there thinking along similar lines, where it was very unusual to find someone with ideas like that in pop music.
Yes. I had quite a strong connection with the classical avant-garde at first. That was really my first musical connection. When I was art college, I was in contact with people like Christian Wolff and Cornelius Cardew. And, of course, I knew what Cage was writing about and so on. So that was sort of the That was the license which allowed me to think that I might be able to do something in music, because a lot of things they were talking about were for non-musicians or for unskilled players, that kind of thing. There was suddenly an idea in the mid-60s that you didn't really have to have gone through the whole academy in order to be able to play music. It was not quite so mysterious. And then at the end of the 60s, a pop group appeared that had a very big influence on me, which was the Velvet Underground, of course the band that John was in. And one of the things they kind of traded on was a mixture of talent from Maureen Tucker, the drummer, who was really a non-musician. She normally played one drum. to Sterling Morrison and John, who were both very good musicians, and Lou Reed, who was maybe somewhere in between. And this, they made quite a point of the fact that this was permissible and in fact could lead to exciting results. Now, I was temperamentally always attracted to popular music. It was what I liked and what I listened to. And I liked the ideas of classical avant-garde music, but I must say I discovered that that was not what I was listening to for sound. For sound, it was pop music where it was happening for me.
In the 1970s, you became a very important producer of new wave bands like Talking Heads. I think some of the new wave bands were into what you were talking about before, approaching music from a non-musician's perspective, or at least from a musician's perspective where technique wasn't the primary way of measuring whether the music was good or not. It was more about feeling and sound and rhythm. What did you want to put into that music? How would you describe the vision that you were bringing to the new wave bands in the late 70s?
Well, you're quite right that I felt that identity with it. I thought that this was a whole movement that shared a philosophical position with the one I'd been working around. I suppose what I felt was that there was something else that could happen as well. It didn't just have to be walk in and bash the instruments hard and walk out again. That there were certain kinds of delicacy that were allowable and actually very fruitful. And my progress through the 70s, if I can call it progress, was towards putting more and more emphasis as a composer on the landscape that I was creating, the musical context within which the song existed, and quite often leaving out the song entirely in the end. So I was really working with texture, and I thought that this was something that I knew about as a result of having by then spent a fair amount of time in studios and worked with electronics and synthesizers and so on. And that was really what I was interested in bringing to those collaborations.
Mm-hmm. Let me get to another aspect of non-musicianship. You produced the Portsmouth Sinfonia record or records, and this was an orchestra of musicians who really couldn't play and who would play classical war horses like the William Tell Overture or Thus Spake Zarathustra. And it was, you know, like the most ragged assemblage you'd ever hear. Did you organize the band?
No, that was the brainchild of Gavin Bryars, an English composer. And it was called the Portsmouth Sinfonia because he was teaching at Portsmouth College of Art, and that grew out of that place, but then it attracted a much wider membership. At our peak, we had, I think, 80 members in the orchestra. And our biggest ever concert, we had an 80-piece orchestra and a 320-piece choir. We did Handel's Hallelujah Chorus at the Royal Albert Hall. But I just must correct something, actually. It wasn't, funnily enough, it wasn't entirely non-musicians. The rule with that orchestra was that anybody could join. Now, they could also be musicians. They didn't have to be non-musicians, but anybody could join. But the rule was that if they joined, they had to turn up at the rehearsals, and they had to try their hardest to play it right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, given that most of the players had absolutely no... Most of the players, I should say, had no musical background, this was guaranteed to fail in an interesting way. But some of the players were actually very skilled, and this was what made it musically interesting, I think, because occasionally you'd hear a thread of very nimble playing amidst this near chaos that was going on most of the time.
Is that what made the project interesting to you?
Yeah, I liked, I loved that. I learnt a lot about music playing in the Portsmouth Symphonia, more than probably any other experience I've had. Because if you get people who can't play instruments very well trying to play melodies that they know, everyone knew the tunes, you know, they were always Beethoven's Fifth and, as you say, the war horses of classical music. Probably the only thing they'll manage to do is to follow the rough shape of the melody. They'll go up when it goes up, and they'll go down when it goes down, but not by the right amount more often than not. So what you got was classical music reduced to its to a sort of statistical averages where you know, where the sum total was kind of roughly recognizable. It was very exciting orchestra to be in. We fired a couple of people because they played around. The one thing that wasn't tolerated was people deliberately making jokes or trying to make it sound funny. It sounded funniest when everyone was trying hard to get it right, and it didn't sound funny when people larked around and made silly noises, you know. So we really did rehearse, and we realized that the quality of the failure depended on how hard we tried to succeed, and we tried very hard.
Brian Eno is my guest. Have you ever gone through a crisis of becoming too proficient at either composing or at using the electronics that you use or tape manipulation? You know, coming from this non-musician background and being informed by the Portsmouth Symphonia stuff about how something sounds when you're really trying hard to do it right and mm-hmm. you can't.
Mm-hmm.
People like you get really good, you know?
Well, it's a good question because I think what happens, it's not so much the over-proficiency that's a problem. It's the lack of alertness that goes with knowing how to do something well. Once you know how to do something quite well, or you're familiar with doing it a lot of times, you automatically are falling into routines. You know exactly how that works. You switch it on, you do this, you do that, you do that. And all of that is sort of done on automatic. And While you're on automatic, you're not listening any longer. One of the reasons that people who don't play instruments well are sometimes able to do surprising things with them is that they're listening at a much more basic level than skilled performers are. They start asking questions like, hey, does this sound interesting? Yeah, it does. at quite a different point from where the professional performer would. He's already been through that. He's already working at a level where he considers all those questions have been answered long ago. They're not interesting to him anymore. So I think this is the problem. It's not proficiency. It's the switching off of your alertness that goes with thinking you are proficient on something. So the trick is to think of ways of surprising yourself back into hearing freshly again. And that's something that really requires thinking and techniques of thinking. It's something you can do quite consciously. You can set yourself exercises that trick you into hearing something differently.
If I could just bring this around to what we were talking about at the beginning, which is your first album of songs in a long time, and I know you were finding it hard to talk about songs or why you were writing them, but I wonder if this connects at all, that since you hadn't been doing albums of songs for a while, maybe there was a freshness in it? in returning?
You know, when you're working on something and you're carrying out a course of work and people react to it, you sort of lose your innocence about it in a way. There are all sorts of expectations, like you're suddenly very important or you're the villain of the piece or whatever you are. You're being cast in... You cast a big shadow, you know, much bigger than you probably intended. And there's a momentum to that kind of public acclaim, actually, public and critical acclaim and condemnation, that tends to keep you... tends to harden positions too much. You have to defend a position or you have to condemn a position. There's a momentum to repeat successes, to break molds, all the various different things. You're not operating in quite the same mental context as I was when I first started making records, where I just thought, this sounds good, I'll release it. with very little thought of what anyone expected of me or what the rest of the world would think about it, or whether the rest of the world would even care about it. Well, this kind of gets a pressure after a while, and it distorts your judgments. And it's sort of an act of courage to ignore that, or to at least work out what one's relationship is to it. About 2 years ago, my father died, and earlier this year, my wife gave birth to a daughter. Now, those two events seem to me so much more important in so many ways than anything else, that it suddenly made all these distinctions between this type of music as opposed to that, this idea as opposed to that, it made them seem rather trivial. Instead of being hundreds of miles apart from one another, in relation to these other things, they seemed rather close together, and it seemed to me that I had a lot of freedom suddenly to move between them. I didn't any longer feel that to do one thing was the dereliction of a position or was a condemnation of something else. So this year I felt very happy, because I think that I've sort of opened up the dynamic of my work, and I can really work anywhere along the spectrum of things that I can do, and not feel that I don't feel ideological about it anymore. I think that's the thing. I feel that it all probably fits together in the end, but I don't care if it doesn't.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your music. Thank you.
Well, thanks a lot.
Brian Eno's new album is a collaboration with John Cale called Wrong Way Up. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's one of Brian Eno's songs from the new album.